What is it, precious? What is it?
My name is Bilbo Baggins.
Bagginses? What is a Bagginses, precious?
I'm a hobbit from the Shire.
Oh, we like goblinses, batses, and fishes, but we haven't tried hobbinses before. Is it soft? Is it juicy?
Now, keep your distance. I'll use this if I have to. I don't want any trouble, you understand? Just show me the way to get out of here, and I'll be on my way.
Why? Is it lost?
Yes, and I want to get unlost as soon as possible.
Oh, we know safe paths for hobbitses. Safe paths in the dark. Shut up!
I didn't say anything.
I wasn't talking to you.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me, as always, are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hi there.
Today we will be talking about The Hobbit. We will also be talking about HFR 3D, also known as 48 frames per second 3D, as well as The Hobbit's route to the big screen and the rise and fall of anticipation for the return to Middle Earth after the first visit with the Lord of the Rings trilogy being ever so popular. So what I want to dive into first, though, is HFR 3D. I think that's been a really controversial topic. And I'll just speak from my perspective that I fucking hated it. And it's not that I'm boo anti-technology or anything like that. If it had worked, great. My problem with HFR 3D, and not just HFR 3D, because I can just describe my problem in a sentence, and I've said it many times. It makes the movie look like a soap opera on fast forward with shitty digital effects. That's what I feel about it. But my issue is with the conversation about HFR 3D, because we're trying to have a conversation where we physically aren't seeing the same thing. Our eyeballs are perceiving something differently. This isn't a matter of craft, but a matter of tech.
Do you want to explain that, just the definition of it quick, just for people who aren't quite familiar with it?
With what?
With
HFR.
48 FPS.
Okay,
HFR.
Okay. For people who aren't familiar with the tech, movies are usually captured at 24 frames per second. Depending on the country, it can be a little different. Britain has different frame rates, but it's around that. 48 frames per second doubles it in an attempt to produce higher clarity of image, especially with regards to 3D. And to its credit, yes, the images in The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, are crystal clear. However, some people, myself included, find that the hyper clarity has created what is a high definition image, but one that is of low fidelity. So what we're seeing doesn't look quite right, even though it is very clear. And so that is the argument we're having, because some people, it works for them beautifully, or they'll see it again and it works beautifully. But this is an issue that we have seen already outside of the movie theater with people who have televisions that are set to 120 hertz. Mm. You may know people who have these HD TVs, and you go and you sit down and not all the programs look right. If you were watching sports or maybe a nature documentary, it would look terrific. But if you're watching commercials or TV shows, it always looks like the image is lagging behind a bit. Not in terms of static, but it's as if characters have to constantly speed up. It's a little too clear. It doesn't look quite right. However, not everyone notices this problem. So again, we come to this issue of trying to make an argument for or against HFR 3D when it comes down to the ability to perceive an image. Not in terms of, oh, I think this would have been better in black and white or shot in this manner. We are talking about the literal ability to perceive movement and arguing over, does that look right? And at that point, it's very difficult to have a conversation about what does HFR 3D mean. And people are writing editorials, and it's as if the editorial can only extend as far as what that one person sees. Because we're clearly not on the same page.
I think it has a lot to do with how much 120 hertz TV you've seen. Because I saw The Hobbit in 48 frames per second and 24 frames per second with a bunch of different people. And the people who don't have that 120 hertz TV or aren't around them very often had like a big problem with it. They said it was really, really jarring.
Did they not get used to it at all, though? That was my experience, because I haven't seen the 120 hertz TVs except like on display in stores. And it was a little jarring at first, but you're there for 2.5 hours. It faded away pretty quickly for me. Did they have problems throughout the entire experience?
It got better. They said it got better, but it never went away completely. And that was my and I've seen a lot of 120 hertz TV, and I still it didn't ever completely go away. And it's not when
I'm with Adam.
It's not when the images are still. It's when they're in motion is when it looks weird. It's when it's that video quality, that British TV of when they're moving, because there's no motion blur and it's just weird. Because we're all used to seeing motion blur, and it doesn't exist in HFR. Blur,
and also, movies recreate the way we perceive the world. I mean, if movies didn't look quite right, we wouldn't notice. I mean, obviously with black and white, there are certain issues there, but with color, it's pretty much how we perceive the world, and that's why 3D itself is jarring. We don't have an infinite depth of field. As things are further away, they're blurrier. That's just how vision works. But we've come to this issue with HFR 3D, and I'm with you, Adam. It's something that it was really jarring from the get-go, and I never got past it. I endured it. I was able to just buckle down and be like, focus on the story, focus on the characters. Because if I ever, for a moment, let myself remember, I couldn't ever just sit back and let the movie come to me. Now, I guess you could argue it made me an active viewer, but really it just felt like I was having to ignore a high buzzing sound in my ears. It's that kind of thing where if it's there, but your brain just eventually has to filter it out. It's not that it makes anything better, but for the purposes of focus, you just have to ignore it. And that's what I did with HFR 3D, is I just had to ignore something that was meant to draw me in even deeper. And
to the extreme for becoming an active viewer, I know a lot of people out there were experiencing actual physical problems from the 48 frames per second in 3D. There are a lot of scenes where, it's twisting, turning, you're flying, you're sort of tumbling over and over. That is where this really falls apart, and it's actually sickening. It's, motion sickness for a lot of people, and they have actual physical responses to it, and that's not what you want your movie to do. It's supposed to be a form of entertainment. It's not it's not an actual thrill ride that you're going on.
Right, and well, we also have this issue of, and we've seen it with 3D outside of HFR 3D, just regular 3D, people who get headaches watching.
Right.
They just get straight-up headaches, and they can't do it.
Well, and that's one thing. My girlfriend absolutely hates 3D. It always makes her sick, and she said that the 3D was great in this. And that's the one thing that I will agree with Peter Jackson, is that the high frame rate greatly improves the 3D and that there's no motion sickness from it. You don't kind of get upset from the 3D. She always gets headaches from 3D, and she always has to take a break for her eyes, and this did not happen at all in this. She said it was a lot better, with regards to the 3D.
Okay. See, this also raises an issue that I think is even, let's backtrack. The issue with how people perceive HFR 3D. Now, I've seen some people who support HFR 3D in The Hobbit. It's like, well, no, but it's not supposed to look real. It's a fantasy world. And I think that's fucking bullshit. I just don't find that to be a convincing argument, because even in a fantasy world, especially the fantasy world that Peter Jackson has created, he didn't create Alice in Wonderland, like Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, that has no grounding. In fact, one of the reasons we love his Middle Earth is the attention to detail, the fact that it feels lived in and real despite being a fantasy film. So this notion that, it shouldn't look real, that's ridiculous. That argument can be maybe applied to other fantasy movies, but not this one.
Well, I've heard Peter Jackson say that this is his goal with this was to make it look more realistic, and that was my problem. I don't want this to look realistic. I want to be transported to a world, and that's not there with the HFR 3D.
Well, I also
see with the HFR and the 3D, I actually found that it worked best for the establishing shots, so the big kind of sweeping epic landscape shots that he uses. The LTR was kind of known for just setting up where the guys happen to be in their journey at the moment, and setting apart the different landscapes. I thought that worked pretty well. Also, sort of the heroic shots. So the slow motion or the still camera with the so like Thor and Oakenshield in The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. I thought those were brilliant and incredibly clear. You could see all the detail. It was great for the costume designers and even the makeup department because their work really shone through. You could see every little single like hair.
No, see, my problem with it is that like the orcs' costumes looked like rubber because they are rubber, and this is HFR, so you're getting a super super clear, realistic image, and I'm seeing this costume that, and I'm thinking in my head like that's a rubber costume, whereas
I didn't have a problem with film.
See, it was just so clear, it just like made all the like production design everything that much more set like.
I had no problems with the actual physical practical production or production design. I had major issues with the visual effects as far as the digital constructions go. Right. We can get into that in a little bit. But
well, I mean, I'll talk about that right now. I'm with you, Dave, in terms of the digital effects. I would say because of the HFR 3D, the digital effects in The Hobbit look worse than what we saw in Lord of the Rings.
Definitely.
And yeah. I think there's a notion of, is this realism an absolute good? Cinema is inherently a trick. When we talk about 24 frames per second, we are talking about 24 still images that are run through to create the illusion of movement, not reality. Cinema itself is an illusion, and that embrace of, oh, well, it has to be more real. No, we want to be fooled. I don't want to see super realistic if it doesn't work. I appreciate the notion of attention to detail for the costumes and all that stuff, but if it breaks other parts of the film, then you know what? I would gladly sacrifice a little less attention to the costumes. Beautiful costumes, beautiful sets. We've noticed them for decades upon decades. They have not gone ignored. And I think this notion of appreciation would still be there whether the resolution were at the level it is with HFR 3D or if it was just regular 2D.
Now, are you guys talking about...
Yeah.
Well, are you guys talking about the visual effects with like the humans with the other things? Because in my experience, I thought that the only aspect of the HFR that I really, really liked was that the CGI created creatures looked great, like the trolls and Gollum.
Which I thought made me they excited. Looked fucking terrible.
I agree with Matt. The trolls were okay, and Gollum was great.
And this is what I mean. We are we can't even agree right. on what looks great and what looks terrible because the way our eyes are perceiving things. This isn't an aesthetic judgment. This is a technical judgment in terms of we're not arguing over a choice, like a lighting choice, or I think they should have gone with this. We are talking about tech, and I find that to be
it's perspective.
Right, it's a perspective thing.
It's not opinion. It's like I literally cannot see what you're saying.
Exactly. And at that point, we can't really convince each other. We can't. If someone writes an editorial telling me about how HFR 3D is the way of the future, I can't agree with that because my eyes aren't working the same way. Now, I do know some people on Twitter have said, "Oh, I went back and saw it in HFR 3D again, and it worked a lot better for me this time." And
it might
be
the novelty of it that you, like I said, throughout this viewing of the first film, I got more used to it. The only thing that really stuck out glaringly to me was the digital effects that weren't up to par with being able to exist in this high frame rate film. But yeah, so it was basically, I got used to it. So I don't know if maybe people get used to it over time or it's not quite so jarring the second time you see it. I don't know.
Well, what I'd like to ask the people who do, quote unquote, get used to it, because for me, the effect of HFR 3D reminded me of these 120 hertz televisions. And every time I'm in front of one of them, I notice it. I can't ignore it. And it just bugs the shit out of me. And I want to go into their settings and be like, let me turn this shit off for you so it looks like real TV again. It's stuff like that. So,
well, not even TV. Like, if you watch a Blu-ray on it, it's exactly the same. Like, it's everything. And that's why, to me, it wasn't as jarring because I've seen Blu-ray. Like, I've watched full films on 120 hertz TVs before. So I know, like, I've seen that soap opera effect. But the problem where it becomes a slippery slope is, and Devin Faraci wrote a great editorial this week talking about how Peter Jackson has been looking at this HFR for like a year and a half now since he's been shooting, and he said that he's used to it, and he said that now he's seeing that 24 frames per second is starting to look weird to him, like he can notice strobing and stuff. And what Devin Faraci said, he said, imagine, like, it's hard enough now to get kids to watch black and white movies because they inherently think they're old. Right. Imagine a world where 100 years of cinema history looks weird, where Star Wars is a relic and you can't watch it because it looks stupid.
Right. I don't know.
That's the slippery slope with, like, HFR becoming, quote-unquote, like, the history of cinema, which I don't think it will happen, but, like, that's why I think it's a terrible idea.
I agree, and I think what's also important is to call out its weaknesses, because I will say this about HFR 3D, it's technology, and technology improves. So maybe the problems we have with it, maybe HFR 3D won't always be as bad as what we're seeing now. Maybe it needs to be refined, and it will get there in time, which is fine, but it could be a case where HFR 3D will simply be a tool. It'll be something where we'll use it on nature documentaries.
Sort of like an IMAX kind convinced. Of form.
Right. And I think it would have been interesting. I think it would have been interesting, and I'm sure it'll probably happen down the line, if there had been a different ticket price point for HFR 3D to have a better idea, perhaps, of how much those screenings contributed. What was the draw to HFR 3D, and maybe that'll be next time, maybe for the second part of The Hobbit, those screens will cost more, but I think even Warner Brothers was a little hesitant about HFR 3D. The number of theaters that had that technology were a smaller portion.
It was like 430 or something like that, and I went to a screening, like I've seen it twice, I saw it in 24 and I saw it in 48 frames per second, and when I saw it in HFR, it was Saturday night and the theater was not full at all. All the other showings were sold out, but not the HFR. And I heard the ticket lady trying to explain it. She was, so like someone who asked what it was, was like, it's a little faster, and
yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
It's tough to
play it a lot faster.
No one. Yeah, you can't explain right. it.
Well, here's the funny thing about the HFR 3D. I personally think most cinemas will be dead within 20 years. So who knows? The whole thing about this about 3D and HFR 3D, it's like, it's going to draw people back to the theaters. But it's like, no, it isn't, because the TVs will advance, and then they'll just stay home again. This is the problem that we're having.
Yeah.
And, again, the whole 3D thing, it's just, I want to see The Hobbit again, not because I'm head over heels in love with the film, and we'll talk about that. But just to be able to experience the movie, because when I saw it in HFR 3D, I wasn't lost in it. I was experiencing HFR 3D. And while
you're distracted by it.
Exactly. And while I applaud Peter Jackson on trying something new in terms of technology, and someone has to take that step, and if it wasn't going to be him, it would have been someone else, and so be it. But at the same time, we do have to call it out. And I think, again, the problem is, we can't really call it out, because some people are like, oh, it doesn't work for me, but if it works for some, then is the technology already where it is? Can it be even better for someone who just automatically perceives it as great? It's not like, I made a comparison in my review, and it's not a perfect comparison, but I said it's kind of like de-aging Jeff Bridges for Tron Legacy, but we were all kind of on the same page that looked like shit.
Yeah.
So, but we're not on the same page.
You take one character and you take one effect and see if it works, and it doesn't. This is like you are exposing the audience to the entire film in this, and there's no way around it. It's not like you're taking a section, shooting it in IMAX, and having that presentation while the rest of it is more or less.
No, absolutely.
What
you expect
from the film. This is everything. So it's all in or nothing. So I would like to see future in HFR for something like a Disney Nature, where they do the actual.
I would love to see that. I would love to see how it functioned in that.
And see
the Avatar sequel.
There.
In the Avatar sequel, I would definitely see it.
Well, as someone who thought it looked great on the visual effects creatures, in my immediate thought was, this is not for everything, but I think it'd be cool to see Avatar 2 in it. But I saw this in 24 frames per second.
Catch up to that.
I saw this in 24 frames per second the first time, and it's not the Lord of the Rings. Like, even though it's like it's projected in 24 frames per second, it still looks super digital. It's like, I was watching Moonrise Kingdom recently, I was rewatching it again, and it's like if Wes Anderson has shot that digitally. It's just, it loses all of the, it's
just
got
too
that
much. There's just not enough locations.
Yeah, and Peter Jackson said like the studio wanted to make sure that by shooting in 48 frames per second it would still look fine in 24, and it doesn't look as pronounced as the high frame rate, and it's not as clear and the motion blur isn't there, but it still looks really, really digital. And that's not what the trilogy looks like. The trilogy was shot on film, and you have that sheen in front of you where you feel like you're transported into a world, or kind of like you're hearing an old story, whereas it just looks, I don't know, it looks digital. Like you see the sets.
It's not
and everything.
Yeah, it's not the right
no,
tech
it ruins
for
it.
The
and
kind
I,
of story
I saw,
they're telling.
Yeah, and I saw Django Unchained the same day, and just thinking about like Tarantino shot that on film, and it just looks so great. Like, it looks like you're transported into this world, and you're just like right into it. And I did not feel that when I first saw The Hobbit, and I saw it in 24 frames per second. Like, I wasn't like I wanted to see it in 24 first so I could focus on the story, but still, it didn't look the same.
So we have to do an experiment now where we find a young child who's never seen a movie, period, and just drop them in.
We are starting up a child kidnapping ring. First with Star Wars, now with this. Who kidnapped all these children? It was the Collision Podcast. For their crazy experiments.
For science.
For science.
But honestly, like, if this becomes more more prevalent, I would be interested to see, like you said, Matt, with the sort of the ticket sales and the proportions of who went to see 48 versus the regular version. I would like to see that over time and see if people start to, I don't know, go towards the high frame rate once it gets a little more refined. That'll be an interesting thing to see.
And I think what's interesting about the HFR 3D, it sort of turned the conversation into a new direction, is the word got out at CinemaCon. They showed some footage in HFR 3D, and that's when some bad buzz started leaking through. I think that first teaser trailer for The Hobbit was amazing, and everyone got really excited, and it was like, oh, we're going back to Middle Earth, and we had heard about it being shot in 48 frames per second, and it's like, oh, well, maybe this will fix 3D. 3D gives me headaches, and so maybe this is the solution. This is what we've been waiting for. And then it came out of CinemaCon that it kind of looks like a soap opera, and then it tamped down a little bit. And then later on, and then at Comic-Con, and around Comic-Con, we heard it was going to be split into three movies.
Right.
This one book that's not even that meaty. This one little book is going to go from two movies, which it could have handled, to three. And then at Comic-Con, and this really got on my nerves, they did not show the footage in HFR 3D.
Right.
They were going to, and then they bailed. And I thought that was a cowardice move. I thought that was...
I think they knew that it wasn't ready. And to be honest, I think they were working on stuff up until, what, a couple days before the premiere?
But they should have shown just a little... If they had something ready for CinemaCon...
No, he has a full cut of Desolation of Smaug done. Like, he was on the Colbert Report, and that's done. Like, this has been... This has been... In the Comic-Con footage, we saw stuff from the second and third movies as well. Like, we saw a lot with Legolas and Evangeline Lilly.
If that's what they think is done, I don't know. I'm a little worried for the next two films.
Well, I think they thought it was going to be a slam dunk at CinemaCon. They were going to be like, you know, they thought the word was going to be like the future of cinema from Peter Jackson. And then it just like, I think they were kind of taken aback by how negative the
reaction
was.
Right, and see, and that's the thing. So Peter Jackson is saying, oh, this is the future of cinema. This is great. I believe in this. It doesn't go over well at CinemaCon. And rather than stick to his guns and risk bad buzz out of Comic-Con, he's like, fuck it, just show it in regular 3D. Good enough. And then we're supposed to trust him when it comes out like that?
Yeah, and there was no build-up to, like, this whole release. I have to imagine there was a plan to do a bunch of marketing on the high frame rate and educating the public on what this is and telling them it's the best way to see it. None of that was
done. I think the video blogs were about as close as it came to explain it.
Yeah, but I'm talking about, like, general audiences.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's tough to explain that, though. It's one of those things where you have to show that to them to get...
But there was no effort to tell audiences what this
was. Right, I don't even think there was an HFR 3D trailer for the film.
No, it was just like you go to the theater and you see this HFR 3D next to the title and you're like, what the hell is that?
I fear change. I don't want to put my money down for something I don't understand.
And the poor ticket lady tries to explain it to you. It's just twice as fast. Twice as
quick. It looks like my stories.
The movie's an hour and a half long.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody talks in really high pitch. It's kind of strange.
You have to go save the Hobbit! You have to go save Erebor!
But actually talking about, like, sort of crowd reaction, fan reaction, and just that buzz, most of the people I talked to, since they knew that we had seen it early, most of my friends that I talked to were like, look, I really want to see this. I'm really excited for the film. I love Lord of the Rings, blah, blah, blah. Should I see it in the 48 frames per second? So I'm asking them, like, well, do you like 3D, or does it give you headaches, or how do you feel about that? Do you get motion sick? Do you have problems with sort of like these?
It's like a doctor. Do you get
it
motion
really,
sickness?
It really is. And honestly, everybody I talked to, regardless of whether they had major issues or just sort of like minor, you know, reservations about it, everybody chose to go see the regular standard format, the 24 frames. They just wanted to go enjoy the movie, enjoy the story, go back to the world and see these characters that they love, you know, whether they had read the book or not. But revisit that world, and it didn't really care that there was this 48 frames per second thing that had at best an ambivalent sort of reaction from people.
And
they just didn't want to do it.
Right. And again, I think someone had to take that step, and yet at the same time, just by virtue of being HFR 3D and the buzz that arose around that format, it kind of took the wind out of the Hobbit's sort of the buzz. I mean, people were still going to see it. It had a record-breaking December opening, but we weren't... For a film that was the first film to return to Middle-earth since The Lord of the Rings, one of the highest-grossing, most beloved trilogy of films ever, to come in at under $100 million on an opening weekend when it had no competition, that is a little underwhelming.
And with the 3D, it was only $15 million more than Return of the King was in its opening weekend.
Right, exactly. So the 3D didn't even boost it as it should have. And so we have all this, and I think part of it was the reviews weren't as ecstatic. That was the other thing. It, for the original trilogy, everyone loves those movies. They are just absolutely... And this was far more mixed in the response.
How did you find the reviews? Did you find that a lot of them, I mean, aside... skewed to just a discussion of the technical aspects of it? Or did they actually do an overview? And
no,
then
they did an overview. I think a lot of people, yeah. Even without looking at the HFR 3D, they just thought the story wasn't as tight.
Sure.
They had problems with the narrative and things of that nature. They actually did have problems with the actual movie instead
of... Because honestly, like the gut, you know, the knee-jerk reaction I saw from a lot of people, nothing about the movie at all. Everybody was just all up on this 48 frames, and a lot of people were just tearing it down. And just indiscriminately, not specific things, just general statements like 48 frames per second is terrible. Like, I got nothing from that. So I was just wondering if, what your guys' reaction was as far as those other reviews, but okay.
No, most of the reviews I've seen have been focused on the story, which is barely anything on the 48 frames per second. Because, again, the general audience doesn't know this, doesn't know what it is, and it's only in like 450 theaters, so.
Right. So that's the other issue, is that we have a film that obviously had huge expectations, and it was a long time in development.
Right.
That was the other thing, and I think there was already a mixed feeling for Peter Jackson coming back, simply because, at least from my perspective, he didn't want to do it. It felt like he was dragged back to it. Guillermo del Toro was originally set to direct. The film was stuck in limbo because of MGM melting down, and so the movie just couldn't get a green light because it was stuck. James Bond was the same way. And Del Toro was like, he had all these designs and all this stuff, but eventually he didn't know.
He spent 2 years on it.
2 years of his life, and the problem was he didn't know how many more years he'd have to spend on it. And so he was like, I gotta go do something else. I'm gonna go
and
do
working,
this.
And he was living in New Zealand. He was away from his home, away from family.
Exactly.
Like, it's not like he was just in LA and just like, oh, I give up.
Right.
He was living in New Zealand for 2 years, and there was like no end in sight, and he had just signed that huge deal with Universal to do like 5 movies there, which now it looks like he's going to be with Warner Brothers for a long time, which is good news.
Universal so.
Warner Brothers and Legendary.
Oh, Legendary. Right. Okay,
yeah,
like you said, he signed
a
contract with Universal.
No, like originally it was, remember he had like those monsters, he was going to do Frankenstein.
Oh, right, yeah. Universal. Well, he has so many projects.
Yeah.
He's going to make movies. I mean, when's that fucking Haunted Mansion movie coming out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's his next one, yeah.
No, not the, we're talking about like the Disney Haunted Mansion.
Oh, actual Haunted Mansion.
He signed on to that.
Right. He's a guy who signs on to things.
Who has 2 Haunted Mansion projects, all right.
In any event, he left the project, and Peter Jackson was always a producer on it, and I think always involved as a writer, maybe. But he eventually, it was sort of something where he kind of came back to it. And then you started seeing the video blogs again, and it looked like Peter Jackson was going back to Peter Jackson, and maybe he was getting away from the guy who made the god-awful Lovely Bones, which is just a crime against God and man. It's like, maybe Peter Jackson's back, and then he gets bogged down in the technology, and it's just this ride where, even though there's so much goodwill built up towards the Lord of the Rings trilogy, it was tough going back to The Hobbit. And I don't think anyone necessarily expected, like, oh, he's going to even do better than The Lord of the Rings. That's an incredibly high bar.
Right.
But I still think that even compared to Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit is, it's an okay movie. It's a fun adventure. And I love the world that he has created.
Right.
I love his vision of Middle-earth. Although I think it would have been interesting to see how Del Toro envisioned Middle-earth. Absolutely. But...
With Jackson back in, he makes that, he now, you know, with everything else being said, he now has that consistency over that 6 films.
Oh, absolutely. It will be Peter Jackson's Middle Earth forever and ever. And just to be clear, it's not like The Hobbit is a prequel on level with the Star Wars. I mean, it's not. It's not a bad.
He's
movie.
Not making shit up here.
He's not making shit up.
Yeah, exactly.
Still well, he kind of is making shit up. He is. He's taking like sentences from the book and expanding them into giant plot points in order to flesh out three movies.
Right.
For some reason. See, and that's the other thing, and that's one of the things that makes me most concerned, is no one is telling Peter Jackson no.
Right.
And I think telling filmmakers no is very important. Not that you should stifle their genius or anything like that, but there has to be some creative...
You need oversight at some point. You need
oversight,
a second set of eyes.
Absolutely, and I think that was a large part of the Star Wars problems with the
absolutely.
Star Wars prequels. Again, no one told George Lucas no.
And I'm wondering if people are still a little bitter about that and maybe drew that connection to
yeah,
this.
Yeah, I can see that happening. And just be wary of prequels in general.
Sure.
So there's also that issue to go through. And again, The Hobbit isn't an amazing... The Hobbit did not capture imaginations like The Lord of the Rings captured imaginations. The Hobbit is... It's a children's book, basically. So to then break that into three movies... I mean, as two films, sure. But then when you're at three... The adaptation no longer becomes one of subtraction, but one of addition, and that's when you can start getting into trouble. So maybe we should start talking about The Hobbit.
Sure thing.
Dave, do you want to give a brief synopsis about this? What the film's about?
Sure. Basically, so this, like Matt said and we've discussed already, this The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, is the first of three prequels to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It basically just centers on the title character, The Hobbit, which is Bilbo Baggins, played by Martin Freeman, who's just kind of this reluctant hobbit, lives by himself, doesn't really want to be bothered by people. He gets visited by a company of rowdy dwarves and a meddling wizard, played by Ian McKellen. And they just kind of scoop him up, take him off on an adventure. The adventure itself, we won't see the actual climax of that until the next film, and probably the end of the next film. And then the third film is sort of the aftermath of everything that happens. So this whole first film is more or less centered on character development, basically just between the hobbit himself, a little bit with the wizard, and then the lead dwarf character played by Richard Armitage, which is Thorin Oakenshield. It's just basically a lot of character development there. There is a classic scene in this first film from the books that I think was handled really well, and it's definitely one of the shining points of this film. But overall, the plot arc is kind of difficult to talk about because there's no endpoint on this quest. They're only a third of the way through the journey. Exactly. Because it wasn't, you know, the book was one volume. It wasn't split into three or even six like the original Lord of the Rings was. So it's just, it's the beginning. It's the first act of this three-act journey.
Right. And so in some ways, it's almost difficult to criticize things that are introduced in this one because we honestly don't know if there's a payoff. The book is very... direct. There's not a lot of setup payoff. It's just things happen sequentially. Very simple.
Right.
Whereas The Hobbit, little things are laid out. Like there's the introduction of the necromancer, and Thorin Oakenshield has this sort of antagonist. It's
Azog.
Azog, who is this orc that they could have killed, but they're like, he'll probably die from his wound. Like they had the chance to finish.
Never come back.
I know. It was so. That was. So fucking stupid. It was just one of those things.
Yeah.
And it was such an easy fix, too. It was such an easy fix. It's like, we thought we had killed him. But it was really based on the assumption.
We just ignored him for a while.
Yeah, it's like, we just assumed he died of his wounds. It's like, you could have cut off his fucking head and just been done with it. But he's like, no.
Well, this is what you're talking about.
And now he comes back as Stumpy Hand.
I think he was pulled from the appendices, and not even in the canon way. That's what I've heard from some, like, big-time Tolkien fans.
Right.
That this wasn't originally how his whole story went down. So this is already this main antagonist. Because, again, it's the first act of this whole journey for them. So, you know, who have they pissed off already?
And what a
apparently
boring antagonist, honestly. It's like, I'll get you, Thorin Oakenshield.
Yeah.
I'll have my revenge.
I saw them setting that up, and I was like, I've seen, like, this barely a brief of this prologue of this story arc, and I know exactly how it's going to go and how it's going to end. And I don't really care to see. Like, you know, they set it up as like, he cut off his hand, and then, you know, he's probably dead. Like, okay, well, he's going to come back, and then he's going to get away, and then he's finally going to kill him in the third movie.
And won't that be rewarding?
Yeah, I mean, it just feels pointless to see us go through the motions to see that. That's how I feel like most of this movie. I feel like
Adam's getting his Nelly today. He's the one who dislikes it the most.
I felt like here's my initial impression when I walked out was that was a really nice extended edition of an unexpected journey.
I agree. Like, I would say that.
Yeah, I would have enjoyed watching that in like the comfort of my own home and get up and make a sandwich. This was easily 45 minutes too long.
To me, I'm perfectly happy spending more time in that world.
Really, you want to hang out with Radagast and his fucking bunny sled?
Yeah, I love that world, and I am a huge fan of Lord of the Rings, and I love the extended editions. I love the world, but there's like all of these tangents made. They were just not interesting. The stakes were, I mean, inherently the stakes are not as high. So you need like there needs to be something to, you know, grow your attention to, you know, keeping you like, why am I invested into this journey? Why am I interested? Oh, you know, they want to get their gold back, and Thorin's just an asshole to this little hobbit, even though he hasn't done anything. So, you know,
see, I'm curious how people who haven't read the story are reacting to this story, and that's hard to sort of suss out. But we already know what the story is and what happens, and then people
see, I haven't read the book.
Adam hasn't.
Oh,
read
you
it.
Haven't?
No, wasn't I haven't read the book.
That's easy to suss out. You just told us what it was. Okay.
Well, he says he knows what's going to happen with, you know, Azog, because Adam has seen movies before.
Well, because it's, yeah, he's seen...
Because I've seen the Lord of the Rings, and I've seen the Uruk-hai, like, and, you know...
Right.
It's essentially...
See, that's an interesting point. So in the Fellowship of the Ring, they sort of throw in this minor antagonist.
Right, this little henchman. He's like the main Uruk-hai guy.
Yeah.
Exactly, and he was awesome. I mean, he was great practical effect in the original one. Well, you know, people still liked him. But guess what? He didn't continue on throughout the entire trilogy because there were bigger baddies to get to.
Exactly.
In this one, I'm really surprised at how they handled this minor antagonist.
Well, more than that, I mean, really,
he's still around.
The purpose of the Uruk-hai guy in Fellowship of the Ring is more than anything, it's a tough, bad guy, but defeating him shows that Aragorn is a badass. Like, it's just one of those things. They work together. It's done to highlight the character. And I guess if Thorin had killed Azog in this movie, you'd be like, oh, Thorin's a badass. Or something like that. It's tough. It's tough. You don't want to repeat yourself, but you have to ultimately consider what is the good of this villain in terms of helping us tell our story. And Azog is an uninteresting villain. He's just there. It's perfunctory.
And as far as repeating yourself, too, there, I would love, when this comes out on Blu-ray, to watch this and watch Fellowship of the Ring. And just do sort of the plot points side by side, replacing Thorin with Aragorn, replacing Bilbo with Frodo, and just seeing kind of how they parallel each other. Because while one is silly, and a lot of it's fun, it's silly, it's less, you know, dramatic and dark. Another one has much more palpable stakes. You can actually feel a sense of dread for the characters, rather than just a bunch of goofballs that are running through having a high time on adventure.
Well, speaking of...
There are points that match up, yeah.
Right, well, speaking of comparing the two films, I think two scenes that really are similar and highlight the differences between why I think Fellowship is better than An Unexpected Journey is the escape from the goblin caves in Hobbit as opposed to the escape from the Mines of Moria in Fellowship. Because...
Right.
The escape in The Hobbit, it's taking full advantage of the 3D. Look how far down we can go. Look how much shit I can put into the frame. And there are so many bridges. I've made a world built out of bridges. And we're seeing the dwarves, you know, run through and stuff. And this is an important point to note. We don't really care that much about the dwarves.
Nope,
we don't really get to know them. In a film that's almost 3 hours long, I still could only name... half the dwarves, and I expect that some people who, and I think having read the book also helped me identify the
dwarves.
Because if I hadn't, it really would have been like handsome dwarf, other handsome dwarf, fat dwarf.
That's where I was. I was like, there's Thorin, and then there's, you know, a Nimbly Bimbly and like the fat one. And
Nimbly Bimbly.
But they don't do anything. Like, there's no, like, I understand, like, I know Peter Jackson has said that he's really interested in fleshing out the characters in these three films. Like, that's great. But in order for me to care in the first film, you've got to do something. Like, I've got to have some kind of investment in these guys, or else they're just kind of like getting in the way.
Exactly. So we don't care about those guys running across Bridge World. And then, but in the Mines of Moria, now granted, the Fellowship is smaller and more diverse.
Right.
But even in terms of pacing, in the script, and Peter Jackson is very proud of this. If you ever listen to like a commentary track or a documentary, he's very proud to tell you that that scene is written as the Fellowship runs down some stairs. But well, the way he accurate. Put it together is it's a huge moment. It's like, oh, the bridge is collapsing. Right. The arrows are coming. It's so perfectly cut together and paced and just all it is running down some stairs. It's not like the whole thing is they're running down an endless staircase of everything. It's not they're not running through an Escher painting. Okay? So you care what happens in that moment, in that scene. It's a great little set piece. It's a and it's a climax to what's already been an spectacular battle. The stuff in the Goblin Caves is really just a theme park ride.
It's a side it's a sideshow. That's really all it is. It's like, oh, we just kind of ended up here, now we got to get out. There was no
and really you've just summed up every action scene in The Hobbit.
And then it just keeps going on. And there's more. Like the one guy when it ended, that guy said that that movie had more innings than Return of the King. Like they get out and I was like, okay, like here's a good point to like you know, give a little tease and go to the next movie. And then like no, you got to bring the other antagonist in. And then you don't even like finish that. Like there's no finality to what happens. It's just
literally
another
a
set piece.
Yeah,
it's just another set piece just to have another set piece.
Right. And so you have a film that is kind of bloated and kind of repetitive. And so you have characters, again, I could not give a shit about Radagast, and I think even though he's done, he's brought in to sort of introduce the necromancer, I think you could have done that, just had Gandalf do it. I mean, Gandalf goes off and does his thing, and then he comes back, and that's just...
Well, and also for the Mirkwood, too, the, sort of the transition from the, what was it, the green, I can't remember the name now, but sort of the natural forest into the Mirkwood, and that's more for, like, fans of the books and the stories, and for people that were even fans of Lord of the Rings, where it was mentioned, but not really talked about. I'm wondering if they're going to flesh that out a little more in the they have to in the next
We have to keep asking, will they flesh it out? And it's something right. where I'll be curious to return to An Unexpected Journey after seeing the next two movies and saying, oh, okay, it kind of does click together. But even on its own, it feels, like Adam said, an extended edition.
But what, like what you were saying, it comes to addition and adaptation. Like the for the reason there's no Tom Bombadil in Fellowship of the Ring, like we're seeing that they're using every single piece of the book in this to extend it out, and it just feel it. Like the Radagast character, like the service that he plays for the film, could have easily been adapted into something else. I mean, that's up for. I mean, Peter Jackson is the creative one. He's the one who's sure. supposed to figure out how to make this compelling without it being drawn out. And it just feels unnecessary to have Radagast there to do all that. Even though, like, I know he serves some very important things, but it's your job to adapt that and to have those things still happen in a different way that's tighter.
Peter Jackson has gone to a very dangerous world of more is better.
Right. Yeah.
You saw that with The Lovely Bones, which should have been a very small, very intimate story about a family coping with grief and instead became, isn't the afterlife fun? And let's put a little mystery thriller in there just for kicks. And then we see this one where...
Even King Kong. I would go so far as to say King Kong.
Yeah, King
too.
Kong as well.
It's not a bad film,
although
but
it's also bloated. Like, that film spends way too much time on the island.
The dinosaur sequence.
And the stuff with, oh gosh, with Jamie Bell and that other guy, it's a relationship that does nothing. So yeah, no one's, it's just more. Someone needs to tell him to pull back. And with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, in a way, you inherently pull back. There's just too much stuff. But he also said, you know, I did make more stuff, but it's the extended editions. And personally, I know a lot of people love the extended editions, and I think they're good. I just think the theatrical versions are better. They're leaner. They're just more to the point. And if you want to be in that world...
better films, but yeah, the extended editions just give you more stuff.
Exactly.
The extended editions are like sitting down with a really good book. Right. It's something that you want to... Like, if you want to do that, that's there for you to do. I really, really, honestly want to see like a truncated edition of The Hobbit. I want to see a two-film adaptation. I want to see what it was supposed to be like. Like, I would be really interested in seeing that on DVD.
I don't know if they've ever done that on a Blu-ray.
I know it's not going to happen, but
no, I
would
mean,
love
I agree.
To see that.
Yeah.
Right, so we have this. But Dave, you really liked the film, and so I felt it was... I enjoyed it. I do enjoy the coming back to Middle-earth. I thought Martin Freeman was fantastic. I thought Ian McKellen is terrific. Richard Armitage, all great. And... It has these great moments, but they're character moments, and I just don't feel that there are enough of them. I think the best scene in the film is the riddles in the dark between Gollum and Bilbo, and that's just a character scene. It's just two characters talking. And when you look at Fellowship, a lot of that is just two characters talking and just having a conversation.
And the better moments, the better scenes happen to be that. They're not necessarily always the big action and fight, because they have this sort of dichotomy, this contrast, where you can have this quiet moment of two characters talking versus the craziness of everybody just, you know, battling it out and fighting for their lives. So those work. And I think they tried to balance that in The Hobbit.
I think they tried to, like, front load a lot of it. Like, all the stuff in Bilbo's house is all the character stuff. But again, it's just like, look at these wacky dwarves. They're coming in and eating. Then they're doing the dishes. Then they sing a song. And...
Well, when Peter Jackson made The Lord of the Rings, he was the director of The Frighteners. He didn't have a long leash. He had a budget,
right.
And he had to get it all done on time. Then he won. Lord of the Rings is crazy successful, won 11 Oscars, he won Best Director, and he gets to do whatever the fuck he wants with whatever budget he has. Then comes King Kong, The Lovely Bones, and now The Hobbit. He's given an unlimited budget, so he's like, oh, I'll just do a bunch of set pieces. Whereas in The Lord of the Rings, it's like, I know I have this much money to get the Battle of Helm's Deep done, so I can do, you know, this many shots, this much. So I've got to this out with more character stuff.
Exactly.
That's,
you have to flesh it out. You have to take time for conversations in it, for some humor. And what's even more frustrating about The Hobbit is he has all these – he wants to do more set pieces. All right, set pieces. All the set pieces are kind of the same. And
different locations, different characters-ish. Yeah, different antagonists, right?
It's really – they all just – they get chased or they get backed into a corner and they're about to get in trouble and then something else saves them. It's like Gandalf saved us. The elves saved us.
And then they hate Bilbo.
And they're like, layabout Bilbo. As if the rest of them were just totally great. As if all the dwarves were just doing their thing and saving the day, and along comes dumb old Bilbo to ruin the party. Like, they all suck.
There's a reason that I did like this movie, and it was mostly because of Bilbo, and not even Freeman so much, but it was mostly because of Bilbo's arc. It kind of got buried. But he does have his moments where, you know, he's reluctant to join. He passes out. He doesn't want to sign their contract. But then he chases him down the trail.
I agree, and I think
his arc is great.
It's a good arc. It's a solid arc, and it's a good contrast to Frodo. Frodo was always Frodo's kind of the opposite. Frodo is someone who wants to go on adventures and then realizes that this is actually not what I expected. Whereas Bilbo forces himself out by a compulsion that he just needs to do it. And even he's not completely sure, but he's along for the ride, and he learns why he's there and what he can do. And so he.
And I'll say this, too, because I don't think I've seen it in any other review, really. I mean, you can point it out if I'm wrong, but I was blown away by the way that they were able to write this film in such a way that it paid an homage to the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but it also didn't spoil things from the Lord of the Rings trilogy for people who haven't seen it yet. So I'm hoping they keep with this track for the prequels, because I feel like at the end of the day, you're going to be able to watch 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You're going to be able to watch the Hobbit prequels and then the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and it'll flow in a cohesive manner. A lot of people were arguing that the Frodo, old Bilbo thing with Ian Holm at the beginning of the movie was unnecessary. I completely disagree. I think it's an establishing point for new members to say, okay, here's our storyteller. Now we're going to have a flashback. Oh, and by the way, his nephew's randomly there.
I would agree with that, because what Return of the King ends basically with Bilbo handing Frodo the book that he's writing at the beginning of the thing. And then I would agree, there's little fun notes.
They tie all this together. Yeah.
Where they talk about what?
Oh, no. I just love the little things in here where they tie it back to Lord of the Rings, but it's also an establishing moment for people who haven't seen it.
So they show Andruil, like the broken sword, and so someone may not get that, but it'll come back, and then...
And then when you see that later, you're like, oh, I remember that, or oh, that looks familiar, let me go back and see exactly what that was.
Right.
Whereas for people who, you know, like most people who have already seen the Lord of the Rings trilogy, it's also a nice throwback to those movies we've already seen. So it really was two birds with one stone, and
I think that did work.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Was kind of the some of the more interesting parts for me were when it was returning, and especially with the White Council scene. But that's because, you know, you're dealing with like the necromancer, and like that's some creepy shit, and I want to know more about that. Sure. But then it gets back to, oh, we gotta go, you know, slay this dragon because he's got our gold.
But I mean, how about the fact that they worked all these in there is, I appreciate it very much. I appreciate the work that went into it. It didn't detract from the story, but it probably confused people who haven't seen Lord of the Rings a little bit. But like Saruman, Christopher Lee, his performance in this, he had to dial back his crazy because he's not to the point that he is in Lord of the Rings yet. and you don't.
But he still had to come off like a douchebag.
Exactly.
And he filmed all of his scenes in London with none of those actors that were there because he can't fly. That's why he's on the other opposite end of the table and doesn't interact with anyone.
Just by himself. Yeah, exactly.
I thought that was funny. They're all just talking.
I didn't know that Christopher Lee doesn't fly places.
He's like 86 years old. He like he's just like he physically can't.
So he did travel for the Lord of the Rings, though.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, how did they pull that off? I thought he was like, John Madden. John Madden only travels in buses. I thought Christopher Lee was the same way.
He travels in a double decker, red London bus. But there are other things like Gandalf, you know, talking to his little moth friend. I mean, it was great to see that kind of come back too. And yeah, the eagles, like Matt mentioned, they appear here, which is kind of a cool thing.
Which is kind of cool, but it raises the same problem that they do in Lord of the Rings, which is why didn't they just... And it's such an easy thing to explain, and then they explain it in the book. The eagles is like, this isn't our business, we think it's too dangerous. We're not going to put our lives in danger on your mission. We'll help you out in this instance.
We'll pop up when it's most...
We are. We really are the eagles ex machina.
Absolutely.
To save the day.
Well, and also one of my favorite scenes was when Gandalf gives Bilbo the elf sword that they find in the cave. There was a really nice moment that really hinted towards the heart and kind of the not like a schmaltzy way, but kind of the like life lessons of Lord of the Rings that I felt that this was missing really badly when Gandalf kind of told them, you know, it's not who you choose to kill, it's who you choose not to kill.
Exactly. It's like
I felt like that was a big hole in this movie, that there was in Lord of the Rings, you know, you had the Sam and Frodo relationship that was, yes, it was cheesy, but it was really sweet and earnest, and none of that, I didn't feel much of that in The Hobbit.
Right. There's not a lot of love in this movie.
Yeah.
So there's also that issue. Now that we've just basically ripped this movie apart.
No, it's
the new Dark Knight Rises.
No.
It's not that far. No, and I don't think this is a bad film.
No, I don't think it is either. It's just we're harping on all the bad things about it.
Yeah, it's just disappointing. I mean, I think just Peter Jackson is on kind of an ego trip. It's just kind of sad to see this. I really wish that Guillermo would have gone through with it.
Well, hopefully some of this pseudo-negative reaction, you know, box office aside, but hopefully some of that will kind of maybe bring him down a little bit.
I doubt it. He doubled down.
After the Lovely Bones, if the Lovely Bones doesn't give you some humility, I don't know.
Well, after CinemaCon, he doubled down. He like became an asshole about it. Like anyone who dared talk to him about the negatives of Hyper
was automatically wrong. Yeah.
So we'll see. Again, what I'm curious to see is, as we move along, will the films become better? Because again, we see plot points being laid out here, but there's no payoff. Whereas obviously in Fellowship, it feels like the adventure continues. Whereas in The Hobbit, it feels like, where does this go?
I was also a little reluctant. Like, I didn't love this movie, but I was all. A part of me wants to reserve judgment until I've seen all three and see.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's tough. It's like watching the first act of the movie and judging the whole thing from it. It's difficult to do.
So come back in a year, folks, and we'll talk about The Hobbit: The Desolation of Smaug. Indeed. All right. So you guys ready to go for recommendations?
Sure thing.
All right, Adam, what do you got for us?
I am recommending another thing that stars Martin Freeman. It's the British television series Sherlock. I'm sure most of you are aware of this. I'm basically recommending it to say, if you've heard of it and you haven't seen it, get off your ass and go watch it. It stars Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch. Cumberbatch is the titular Sherlock, and Martin Freeman is Dr. John
and
Watson.
And Benedict Cumberbatch will be the voice of Smaug in Desolation of Smaug.
It will
all
be
connected, kids.
The show was created by Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss. Stephen Moffat runs Doctor Who, for all of you Who fans. I'm sure if you're a Who fan, you are already obsessed with Sherlock. But it's really, really a really excellently done modern iteration of Sherlock. There are only 6 episodes. Each episode is 90 minutes long. There's 2 seasons. They're on Netflix Instant right now. Go over there, watch them. They're really, really great. And Cumberbatch and Freeman are also excellent in this.
Okay. I also like about Sherlock, it's basically, because each episode, like you said, is 90 minutes, you're basically getting 6 movies when you watch
Sherlock.
Yeah,
they're like 90 movies. And it's like, it appeals to that, like, procedural aspect that everyone's, you know, you get sucked into, like, a Law and Order marathon or something like that. But it's also really, really well done with really kind of great character arcs and character stuff.
Okay, cool. Sherlock. Dave, what about you?
I'm going to go back to 1988 and another adventure classic that actually wraps up a whole quest in one movie, believe it or not. 1988's Willow. This is directed by Ron Howard and written partially by George Lucas. It stars Warwick Davis as Willow Ufgood, who is technically a dwarf, but not the dwarves that we're used to from Middle-earth. They're not really warriors. They're just kind of, they're little people that are just kind of, you know, farmers and villagers and sort of peasant folk. They're not really out for conquest or gold or anything like that. Willow happens upon this baby that sort of just appears, who happens to be at the center of this sort of call of destiny, this prophecy, that this child is supposed to bring about the downfall of this evil queen, Bavmorda. The names in this thing are absolutely fantastic, too. It's a great classic sort of swords and sorcery adventure flick. So basically, Willow has to find the guardian for this baby, but also protect her on the way. And he sort of puts his own sort of company together, one including Mad Mardigan, who's a swordsman played by Val Kilmer, who's excellent in this movie. He's actually really funny, but charming at the same time, and more or less believable as an action hero. He was kind of outdone by the action heroes of the 80s, who were more into the realistic kind of shoot 'em up, blow 'em up actions. But this is a good old-fashioned sword and sorcery flick. Also, Joanne Whalley plays Sorsha, who's kind of this double-dealing warrior, but also a love interest for Val Kilmer. And I actually found out the other day that Willow is going to appear for the first time on Blu-ray this coming March for its 25th anniversary. So that'll be the first time that we can pick that up. It's going to be completely restored. Going to have a ton of deleted scenes, extra material. I think Davis actually has a video, I'm not sure if it's a video diary or audio diary sort of commentary track about the making of Willow. And there's, I think, some intros by like Ron Howard and stuff too. So if you guys haven't seen it, you can wait till March to pick it up, or it's probably on Netflix or Amazon. You can check it out there too. So Willow, 1988.
All right. I will finish up by recommending Peter Jackson's 1994 film, Heavenly Creatures. Peter Jackson, before doing Lord of the Rings, was known mostly for genre stuff. He had done a film called Bad Taste, and another one, Dead Alive, and another one called Meet the Feebles, which is sort of about these foul-mouthed puppets. And Heavenly Creatures is a drama. It's based on a true story about these two teenage girls who fell in love and then plotted to kill the mother of one of them when it was clear that they would probably be pulled apart. And so the film is actually the screen debut of both Melanie Lynskey and Kate Winslet. They play the two young girls, Pauline Parker and Juliet Hulme, respectively. So you have these two girls, and they're sort of bonding, and they come together over the fact that they can create sort of this fantastical world. They write stories, and they sort of make these clay figures, and what Peter Jackson does is he sort of lets us into their imagination and the world that they're creating in their heads as the parental figures sort of start surrounding them and see that the homosexual relationship developing between them is unhealthy, quote-unquote, and try to pull them apart, and the film becomes very dark. And it's just a very moving, sad, small film. It's very intimate. And when I heard that Peter Jackson was doing Lovely Bones, I'm like, oh, wow, maybe he's returning to Heavenly Creatures. And I could not have been more wrong. So I would strongly recommend checking out Heavenly Creatures. It's unlike anything else Jackson has done, but I think it is easily one of his best. So Heavenly Creatures.
I have to throw a tag in for Willow real quick because I just found this.
We're done with Willow now, Dave.
Too bad. Willow on Blu-ray. We talked about visual effects a lot today. It was actually nominated for two Oscars, one for sound effects editing, but another one for best effects visual effects too. So compare Willow's 88 effects to those of the high frame rate edition of The Hobbit, and you let me know which one you think is better.
All right. So we will be back next week, and I don't know what we'll be talking about. Will we be talking about Jack Reacher? Will we be talking about This Is 40? Will we be talking about The Guilt Trip? Probably not The Guilt Trip. But who knows? So come back next week. And if you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter, Matt Goldberg. You can also follow my lovely co-podcasters. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you next week.